and they volunteer to serve on the staff of a planetary prince for a whole dispensation. And they're reinvested with material bodies of flesh and blood. These bodies are put together for the light carriers with the assistance of the physical controllers, just like they reconstructed Lazarus' body. They practically had to rebuild that body because cellular decay had set in. Technically quite a difficult job for them. And these are the physical go-betweens who make real to the mortals of Earth, of an inhabited world, the invisible planetary prince. You can see them. Do you ever stop and think that if Caligastia had arrived in the days of Andon and Fanta, that the staff of 100 would virtually have outnumbered the human race? There were less than 100 people alive, even when the grandchildren began coming along. And they died, Andon and Fanta died before they had very many great-grandchildren. Why didn't they do that? Think what a head start mankind would have gotten had the arts of Dalmatia been taught to the aboriginal Andonites right from scratch. The human race would have started out civilized, virtually.
Builders are far behind. Do you suppose that all the seven super universes, all the planets and all the seven super universes except Urantia is going to be settled in light and life? They're going to have to wait on us?
No. No.
I see
a great future for the human race, Roma. If we keep on being ornery, we'll keep killing each other off until we finally get all the ornery ones killed off.
I think the ornery ones don't kill all the good ones, is the way they're going, huh?
Well, I think the Patagonians and the Eskimos will make it.
You know, I know that as many of you here have thought we heard that it said that during the Civil War, one family, that if they had all gotten killed off,
there
wouldn't be so many other people now?
Yep. Well, I've asked myself, why didn't Caligastia
arrive? Well, you think it had a reason.
Yeah, I think there's a premium on doing it the hard way.
Oh?
And if you compare the character of an Agandander with a non-Agandander, you're evaluating the premium. Agandanders are tougher people. They've got more courage. They've got more on the ball. They may not be quite as refined to start with, but they are a lot more dependable in difficult situations. I think they deliberately withheld this help to throw man back on his natural resources. While we wait for Burke. You want to turn this off now?
Mm-hmm.
You know how.
They go together.
Yes, they do. Boo. I just didn't want that thing to go on so long with nothing happening. I wanted to get something out.
We differ in so many ways. We had 9 races here instead of 4 or 7, which are normal. Sometimes there are only 3 evolutionary races: red, yellow, blue. Sometimes there are 6. There's either 3 or 6 normally. But we live evolutionary plus the Adamite. So it adds up to 4 or 7, but not 9. Our planetary prince came late. He rebelled. We get our material son and daughter and lost them within 500 years. We're shy. We're missing, with one notable exception in our group, our normal percentage of Adamic blood. And you see, when they They plan for people to be 50% Adamite. Now, when the Adamites got down to about a sixth to an eighth Adamite, they quit calling them Adamites. They got a new name for them. They call them Andites. An eighth is about 12.5%, and the sixth would be 16.3%. So you're talking about 12 to 16% Adamic. That was the Andite range. Now, when this gets thinned out, still more. Then they call them the white race. I would guess that, again, with certain exceptions, we range from 3 to 5% Adamite. Now, when you try to visualize a blended race, if we are basic Cro-Magnon stock, blue man, carrying a little 5%, 4%, 3% dosages of blood of Adam, what do you suppose a Negro would look like who was 50% Adamic? This would be quite a person, wouldn't it?
What do you think?
I think he'd be a very handsome individual. And when you stop and think of that musical nature, that poetic nature, fired with the Adamic imagination, these would be the great poets of Earth. These would be the great musicians of Earth. They do pretty well with almost no Adamic blood, except as it's infiltrated through the white man. The Negro has no Adamic blood, except in East Africa. There's a little trickle of it down the Nile and across from Arabia.
Bill, we have a blue man here in the city. Now, there are some Indians, are there not, who are blue?
No.
This man is as blue as blue.
Well, I wouldn't know about him. I suspect bad circulation.
No, it's a shading of the Indian color.
The Indians are basically copper
East
and red. Do you remember how the colored races fared here on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
As they spread out from Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
The red man got to farther Asia, followed by the yellow man. And they say that was the greatest epic fight of the history of the human race, was the toe-to-toe slugging match between red man and yellow man for the mastery of Asia. And the red man had the edge in the beginning because he was slightly the better fighter of the two. But the yellow man had more social cohesion. And at an earlier age, he stopped fighting among himself. And when he did, since the red man didn't, the Chinese began grinding him like a juggernaut up against the retreating glacier. And about 80,000 years ago, what was left of the red race was slugging it out for existence, with its back to the ice, and the yellow man moving in. And when Bering Isthmus opened up, the red men fled to North America. The pure red men were mostly in North America. The groups in Central, South, Middle America and South America were not pure red. In North America, the red man never did stop fighting among himself. In Middle America, Central America plus Mexico, and in South America, they built civilizations.
And there were some Adamites got across.
There was
in
one
South
boatload,
America,
one boatload made it across the Pacific.
And no doubt they are the founding of the builders of the marvelous Aztecs.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Inca down in South America.
Inca, yeah.
The orange race moved in towards Palestine. The green race split. Some got into southeastern Asia. There's some traces of them still there, but they're pretty well churned up and submerged. The green race moved, western wing moved in after the orange men, slugged it out, and exterminated them. In turn, were flooded for the exodus of the indigo people, the black people. Were the last to move, and they moved pretty well down into Africa, although you find traces of them all across India, in through the East Indies and as far as Australia. The oldest people over there, I think, are submerged remnants of the black race. The blue man moved to Europe and pretty much stayed there. He was the pre-Cro-Magnon race in Europe. And that's about the way things looked when the Adamites arrived. Set up the first garden, blew up its culture through a couple of mistakes, moved to the Tigris and Euphrates Valley, settled down there about 37,000 years ago, about 35,000 BC. And this is why everything seems to come out of the Fertile Crescent. And had I told you folks about the new discoveries at Jericho? Well, there's always been a big gap between the findings of archaeology and the teachings in the Blue Book. A tremendous gap. Because civilization is dated from, at the earliest, 5,000 BC, usually 4,000. Well, now at Jericho, in Palestine, they have done some digging. And it's been just like the atom bomb in archaeology. They suddenly jumped civilization back almost twice as far. And they've done this with radioactive carbon-14 dating. Otherwise, this poor digger over there would be laughed to scorn, but they can't laugh this carbon-14 dating off. Now, Toynbee writes this up in his volume 12. They've gone down to the late Pleistocene. This is almost 10,000 BC. And in the third level in Jericho, as far down as they go, on the third level from the bottom, there's a sudden change in culture. And mature pottery is suddenly introduced. And this is not primitive pottery, this is mature pottery. And archaeologists recognize this. So they know that near the bottom of Jericho, which is almost twice as old as anything they know anything about, suddenly people moved in there who came from some place that had a much older culture than Jericho. Jericho is the oldest that they found, and they know that there's something around there much older than Jericho. That's the first archaeological breakthrough that's really shattered. Jericho may be dated as far back as 8 or 9,000 BC, and they know that there's something in the Near East that's a lot older than Jericho because this pottery had to grow up somewhere. This is the first reach back towards the time scale of the Blue Book.
Can you see them someday going back up to the Blue Book tells us about the Garden of Eden going out again as they're doing down in the Gulf of Mexico? And they
could be.
So now let's see what they find regarding it.
Could be.
Okay. That's a hard good.
Who's that? That was Clyde. You thought you'd shot somebody else. I don't. I'm going to call him Bill. Just to complete racial history, as long as we've gone this far, the Adamites kept moving up into Turkestan, and there they mixed with the Nadites and whoever else was around there, milled around. And in that area, they built up a reserve of population. Turkestan was then in the fluvial period. There was a lot more rain in through Europe. And that whole area, back about 15,000, 12,000 BC. This is recognized. For example, it's questionable that you could get into Europe very easily across the Russian plains. The Pripet marshes in Poland during this rainier season probably formed an almost impassable barrier into Europe. The earliest endemic infiltration of Europe took place before the Mediterranean flooded, when the Mediterranean was a series of lakes, when there was an isthmus at Gibraltar, and they probably entered Europe through the Sicilian land bridge. Henry Fairfield Osborne, in his Men of the Old Stone Age, records the finding of two of the darndest skeletons in Italy. The skeletons are about 7.5 feet tall, and they are they look like unusually well-proportioned human beings, and I think those are skeletons of Adamites. He notes it and passes it because it just doesn't fit in anywhere.
They weren't Adamites, they had a lot of Adamic.
They were half Adamic. The Adamic infiltration into the blue rays produced the Cro-Magnon type and explains the sudden efflorescence of art in the Cro-Magnon. The cave paintings were by blue men who received a dosage of Adamic blood. Then, visualize, if you will, all this story is beautifully imagined in Wilder End, when he talks about the dawn of civilization, men fleeing from the brazen sun and the burning sky and the drying up of the streams. This is what happened in Turkestan. Each year there was less rain. Streams ran dry. Wells dried up. Oases became untenable. And population pressure built up in the Asiatic steppes. This is the same kind of climatic change that Huntington writes about in his Climate and Civilization, which explains why the Sumerians, the Scythians, the Sarmatians, the Huns, the Alans, all of them came out of Asia. The Khazars, still later. In these waves, the barbarians would beat across the Russian steppes and hit Europe, driving other peoples in front of them. Well, the first great wave, I suspect, came out of Turkestan along about 10,000, 9,000, 6,000 BC. And as you see these Andites moving across the Russian steppes, intermarrying or killing, if the people looked degenerate, they ruthlessly exterminated them. They initiated them into the happy hunting grounds by lethal submersion in water. And if they didn't kill them, they took them into the tribes and married them. Because there must have been a lot of Neanderthal blood still floating around there. You're seeing the Andites gradually transform themselves into the white race. And as they move across Europe, as it's beginning to dry up, they swamp all northern Europe, Scandinavia, driving the earlier Andonites north, where they still exist as the Laps, the dark Swedes, if you please. And you then see another great epic fight, although a shorter one, the slug match, the slugfest for Europe, between the Cro-Magnons and the Andites. And as they say, the Andite military headquarters was in Denmark, recently up from the sea. And the Andite commander, in the last battle of the Marne, when they smashed the Cro-Magnon defenses, was a guy by the name of Thor. And they still worship him in early Scandinavia.
T-H-O-R.
T-H-O-R. He was a real person. He was an Andite military.
Thor is...
Yeah.
I
don't remember that. It's in there. They don't mention Odin, but they mention Thor.
Where do you find that? Is that
that's in part three.
Oh,
okay. Well, Will Durant mentions
he doesn't know about Thor.
Like no.
He knows about the spread from Turkey.
That's
he's
right.
Got that figured out. You see the gradual milieu in Europe that churns up the white man in Europe, and probably the Basques and possibly the Berber. Certainly the Basque was the last remnant of the pre-Andite or pre-white people, because their language doesn't fit anything. They're not Cro-Magnons because there's been too much intermarriage, but I bet a cookie the Basque language is a non-white, a pre-white language that's residual in Europe. At the same time, there's a little bunch of them got into North China. Not so many in numbers, but just enough bringing their artifacts, their painted pottery, to quicken Chinese civilization in the Shang Dynasty and the Big Bend of the Yellow River. This is supposed to be a mythical dynasty, but in the last generation or so, they dug down and they found the bronze castings and the porcelain. And the early Chinese writing, the Shang Dynasty, is not a myth.
Bill, why are there so many languages in India?
I'm coming to that. Some of these got to India. There's been wave after wave of invasion in India. India is the darndest melting pot in the world. Virtually every race has gotten to India in some measure. The earliest Andite invasions probably produced the Indus civilization, which has been dug up in Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa along the Indus River. And these people lived in comfort. These people were contemporary with Sumeria. They had inside plumbing and flush arrangements for sewage disposal. They not only had grandiose public buildings, they had very comfortable private dwellings. They moved on. The culture is broken. But this is the genesis of Dravidian or pre-Aryan civilization in India. And they entered into commercial intercourse with Sumeria and possibly Egypt. The Aryans came in 2,000 years later and produced the final invasion of India. I think probably the last residue of the Andites in Central Asia was the eruption under the Mongols, and Genghis Khan was a gray-eyed individual and came from a gray-eyed tribe. This smells like Andite blood. And as it says, when the Andites lost the specific traditions of Eden, they became the most formidable militarists the world has ever seen. And Genghis Khan is a conqueror alongside of which Alexander, Napoleon looked like parvenus. Genghis Khan had lieutenant generals working for him of the caliber of Napoleon, of the caliber of Robert E. Lee, of the caliber of Alexander and Caesar. You know, we're pretty conceited members of Western civilization, but when Genghis Khan surveyed the world and looked at the richness of China and the moth-eaten poverty of Europe, he picked China for his personal command, and he sent one of his lieutenants to knock off Europe at the same time. The Chinese were millionaires, and the Europeans were still scrabbling. And the European defense against the Mongols is the most pathetic thing you've ever read of. The average European army outnumbered the Mongols and were totally outgeneraled by the Mongols. The Europeans didn't know that the Mongols were coming. The Mongols sat at Kiev in Russia under Subotai, who could neither read nor write, but whose scouts had scouted the entire peninsula of Europe, because as Subotai would look at it, Europe is not a continent, it's a peninsula of Asia. And from Kiev, Subotai launched a three-pronged attack. This is where Hitler learned the Keg und Kessel technique that he used against the Russians. He launched a three-pronged pincers movement against Budapest. And there were two more prongs of cavalry that covered the flank. The northern Mongol cavalry skirted the Baltic, The southern Mongol cavalry skirted the Adriatic Sea at the complete envelopment of the European peninsula. One of his corps commanders was a day late, arriving in front of Budapest and was court-martialed for being one day late starting from Kiev. This was the synchrony they had. The average European army outnumbered the average Mongol army, but was whipped to a fairly well by vastly superior Mongol tactics. The European tradition is that the Mongols overwhelmed them. The facts of the matter are the Mongols outfought them. Well, this is a long ways from planetary mortal ethics. So the story of Genghis has always fascinated me. He had a very simple philosophy. He said, there's one God in heaven, there shall be one ruler on earth. And nearer than any other man, he almost made that joke.
Coming very close to
the truth. Yeah. I think our world differs from the norm in that warfare has gone over into the post-Adamic age of invention. The post-Adamic age, in its later reaches, is the time of scientific development. War is normal on all evolutionary worlds. But scientific, mechanized warfare, I think, is the exception to the rule. I think that by the time men have begun to unlock the storehouse of science, war has been ended because the races have been blended and a planetary government or its equivalent has been established. Now let's just stop and reason. Let's say that each of us was like one of us and had a very high percentage of Adamic blood. And away in the Levant is a city called Eden. And there are Adam and Eve, from whom all Adamic inheritance comes. And there you have the biologic father and mother of all mankind. Because since we carry their blood in our veins, we are, to some degree, their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so on. And there you have a tremendous unifying force on a planet. And this Adam and this Eve, can exert a compelling authority over mankind because they do not use force. They set fashion. Let's just reason by analogy. If the Congress of the United States decreed that women's skirts should come up 3 inches this year, there would be a mass revolt on the part of every woman in the United States. The Prohibition Amendment establishes that. But if some characters in Paris who have no authority say that women's skirts will come up 3 inches this year, well, I haven't seen so many knees since the 1920s, have you? And yours are very attractive, Wilma. Do you see how
I agree with it?
Do you see how much more authority there is when you don't have power, when you set style? This is in the human race. Hollywood is the American court, the American equivalent of the British royal family. And the reason there can never be a Hollywood in England is because they have an official Hollywood.
Well, I think the newspapers trying to make something like that out of the Kennedy family.
Yes, I think so. But that'll pass.
Tired of the Kennedy family on the newspapers, magazines.
Well, it's the first time we've had a cute kid in the White House in a long time.
It's getting the Kennedy.
Sure.
Yeah, and she is informant and all that.
Now, I take the London Illustrated News.
Right.
Princess Margaret and the Duchess of Kent and Princess Alexandria. There's no room for movie actresses. I think ours are prettier and theirs are better cultured. But you see my point? These institutions articulate in society. And this is, I think, was the intended function of Eden. Eden is going to set the style in the world. And the fashions established by Adam and Eve, the ethics, the moral values, would have much more compulsion than if they had law behind them. In the same sense that Paris